again, and welcome to another edition of What We Just Watched from TV Cream. I'm Chris.
And I'm Ian.
And we're going to start with my programme. Right, well, here we go.
Okay. It's very sci-fi, very high-tech.
Yes. What are we seeing?
Lots of pylons.
What's happening with the pylons?
There's power is running through the pylons.
So what sort of show do you think this might be, Ian?
Is it a music show or a...
Yes. We might be about to see what it is.
It's the...
Any guesses?
The... Does it begin with the...
Is it, yes.
Is it the tube, the Roxy? It is the Roxy. Just in
yes,
time.
It is the Roxy.
Just in time.
So now we're going to watch that episode. So we've just watched the first edition of ITV's The Roxy from the 9th of June 1987. So I'm going to kick off, Ian, with the eternal question. Did you enjoy it?
Enjoy is not a word that I'd use to describe my response. The only bit of the programme that I liked, if I'm being brutally honest, was reading the credits at the end.
Well, is there a more damning indictment than that? I think we should just sort of kind of explain what The Roxy was.
Yes.
It was essentially ITV's answer to Top of the Pops. That was how it was described at the time.
And as you said, while we were watching it, that immediately raises the question, well, if you've got one Top of the Pops, why even try and do another one?
I mean, this was an idea which had been sort of kicked around quite a lot at the time. ITV should have its own answer to Top of the Pops. There doesn't seem to be any actual point to it other than just doing a similar show to what was on BBC One at the time. And I'm still, you know, at 30 years later, I'm still not entirely sure what they were thinking of.
Well, how was it sold at the time? Was it...
As ITV's answer to Top of the Pops.
And that was it. They didn't even try and say, well, we're going to be showing you more of this.
Well, I think if we talk about sort of the mechanics of how the Roxy worked, you can see that they were trying to go for a slightly more raw feel to it and a slightly more live feel.
You hear on the Roxy, it's broken English.
Even though they were still miming. But we should talk about the set, because actually, the Roxy is a place, isn't it?
Mm.
It's sort of this ageing sort of ballroom where acts come to perform.
The name, certainly at the time, would have had a connotation of your sort of everyday municipal discotheque slash ballroom.
I think they were aiming slightly higher.
But the name had connotations. It would be where you would.
It's the name of a comedy. It's the name of a comedy cinema, isn't it?
Traditionally, you would have gone.
Are you going down the Roxy
for your entertainment of a weeknight or whatever? And so they were trying to play on that, on people's associations with.
But
that.
But the look of it, the set is kind of.
The set's dreadful.
Do you think so?
Yeah. It's so dark. Well, all right then. Let's just go through what's wrong with it, and then you can tell me if you describe.
All right.
First of all, there's only one place for the artist to perform.
Okay, so we should explain that kind of there is a sort of main stage. Which the audience are sort of arranged around.
Yes.
There's a little sort of catwalk in front of the stage, isn't there? Where kind of if you had sort of a solo artist, they could sort of perform on that.
But the big problem here is that unlike Top of the Pops, where you can mix up the artists and the different sets, and you can put bands in locations which fitted their song and play with the way that the bands are being visually presented, here they all have to perform in the same space, and so every performance looks the same.
I couldn't argue with that. I think the look of the set, it does look quite elaborate, it looks quite large. I think a lot of money had been spent on that.
But they hadn't shelled out anything enough for lights and sound, because you can barely see them and you can barely hear them.
Well, Well, I couldn't argue with that point. I also want to talk about one of the other aspects of the set, which I'm not sure we kind of agreed on either, which was there's a DJ set where we kind of see a kind of one of the presenters, Kevin Sharkey.
Now, I'm up here in the DJ box with ex-Culture Club member John Moss and Steve Lambert.
He's kind of interviewing people, and there's a DJ who is supposedly sort of looks like he's mixing, but there's no music.
No.
But he's checking his headphones. He's kind of doing...
He looked like he was about 50 as well. Probably a chap from a mobile disco who just got in from down the road.
And there's also a bar area where the other presenter, Kid Jensen, is seen sort of linking into the charts.
And right now it's time for the kid to lift the lid on our brand new network chart, compiled for us each week by the computers at MRIB.
And we see the punters sort of walking through. At one point, we see a couple having a snog, a cheeky snog by the bar while kids trying to...
It's very distracting, I have to say.
Yeah. I think a lot of this was in response to the public perception of Top of the Pops at this time, which I think was not a positive one. I think the perception with a lot of the audience was Top of the Pops had sort of peaked. It was going through sort of a midlife crisis. There were, people always complained about miming on Top of the Pops, and it was seen as this kind of sort of slightly antiseptic, slightly plastic show.
Mm. Okay, welcome to Top of the Pops on a Thursday night. We've got some great music for you, some great videos. Terence Trent D'Arby, Pet Shop Boys, and Bruce Willis later on.
And I think you can see with the Rock Theatre trying to make it look more live, the irony being that they're still just miming to pop records.
Yes,
but they're trying to make it look more like a concert, a live concert experience.
I think there's also possibly you can see the influence of the Tube here.
Yeah, because it was made by Tyne Tees, also made the Tube.
And the Tube had been cancelled a few months earlier.
Yeah.
It's been a wonderful 5 years, but you're going to miss us when we're gone, because you don't appreciate us until next Friday you switch on the telly and it's some old poo.
And the Tube had obviously changed the way live music shows appeared on television. Yeah. And it strikes me that here they're trying to think, well, we're not doing it live, but let's see if we can get some of the essence of the Tube in the slightly ramshackle nature. But wed that to a sort of mainstream pop chart.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the flaws with the Roxy.
It's neither one thing or the other.
Exactly. Really. So Ian, I think you've got a few more issues with the Roxy. Do you wanna talk us through them?
I'll mention one particular, which is the presence of David Kidd Jensen.
Right.
Because, I suspect that he looks back on this as one of the... I hope he would look back on this as one of the biggest career blunders
okay.
that he's ever made. I can imagine he was pitched... Oh, great, look, kid.
Yes.
We know that you've been associated with Toth Pots for ages.
Yeah.
You're not on it as much. In fact, I'm not even sure whether he was on it at all.
Well, I mean, at this point, he was on Capital Radio in London, and he was also presenting the network chart show on independent local radio on Sunday afternoons.
Hi there, it's David Kidd Jensen here with the very first network chart show coming at you right across the nation on independent radio.
Which I imagine is why he got the job, because the Roxy was based around
the network chart, the records you buy and the records you listen to on your independent station.
So he'd sort of severed ties with the BBC
yes.
at this point. Yeah. Okie doke. Straight away, we see him with this other chap. I don't know.
Well, Kevin Sharkey.
Yes.
He'd been presenting on pop programmes on Irish television prior to doing the Roxy. I think poor Kid Jensen, as inevitably we're always going to call him, he's always going to suffer by comparison with his era on Top of the Pops, where he was always paired with John Peel, and they had their Rhythm Pals act.
Hello and welcome to another live Top of the Pops. Now, I want you to know, these causes are his idea.
He's only sulking because he wanted to be made Marianne.
And they took it very kind of humorously, which he doesn't do here.
No, they're trying to treat it with a gravity that it doesn't deserve.
Right.
And also, Jensen, or rather Kid, he keeps flitting about the set. Sometimes we see him in that box overlooking the stage.
Yeah.
Then he's in that sort of... It's like a sort of a ticket booth where you'd... Or no, it's a cloakroom.
It's a bar. Sure, it's a bar.
Is it? I didn't see any drinks there. It looked to me like a place where you'd take your coats. It's the cloakroom attendance.
So we've got Kid manning the cloakroom, that's what you're saying.
That's what it looked like to me.
Well, I kind of feel that they were trying to sort of show off the breadth of the set.
Well, yeah.
But I want to talk about the network chart because, you know, as a teenager, I was very militant about the existence of the network chart. I refused to acknowledge
it. It existed.
Exactly. It was,
I think that was a fair approach.
I think to borrow the phrase of the BBC Gaelic chart was the only chart that counts.
Yeah.
So you've got this issue where you're kind of basing a ITV's pop show around a chart which didn't really seem to count for very much. And I'm also imagining people watching that going, the network what?
Yeah.
Like your mum would like be going, what, the network chart? Yeah. I don't, what,
and also,
what's
oh,
that?
And I heard the top 40 on Sunday.
Yeah.
And it had so-and-so in it. And where are they?
Yes.
And that ties in with another problem, which is when we get this chart rundown of the top 20, which Kid reads out, he doesn't mention any of the song names.
Up four to number 20 goes the Wizard from Oz, John Farnham. At 19, former Shalimar Chanteuse, Jody Watley.
That is a huge flaw. But what we do get in the chart rundown are, well, we get a message, don't we? We get a message from one of the acts in the chart.
Halfway through the chart, a little picture pops up with Suzanne Vega.
Yes.
And she says something like,
"Hi, I'm Suzanne Vega, and you're watching The Roxy."
We need to talk about the very first few seconds of the show, where we get a voiceover.
Hey, pop pickers, here it is, at last, for all you music lovers, The Roxy. All right.
From someone who never appears on the show again, and that person is...
It's Fluff.
Alan Freeman. Now, I love Alan Freeman, but if I was launching an exciting new young pop show in 1987, he would not have been the person I would have chosen to deliver the opening address.
You'd want one of the biggest stars of the day to appear in person and say, "Hi, I'm so and so. I'm here in Newcastle, and welcome to the biggest show on television."
And he never appears again. He's got nothing to do with the show. And then after Fluff delivers his message, we get the theme tune, which is composed by Simon May.
"Somebody's nicked my bloody boat!"
And which I think is perhaps one of the least appropriate pieces of music to open a pop show.
It would not have... I've never heard. Your milkman would not have been whistling that tune the morning after, would he?
Just that, it's that it doesn't belong in music television. It's more like a panel game theme or a consumer magazine show, isn't it?
I couldn't argue with that at all. So we should talk about the acts on the show and the way that they're sort of presented.
Yeah.
So we start with Erasure.
"This time I won't end up another victim of love."
Who are performing their hit Victim of Love. And what's the first thing we see?
Well, it's not Erasure.
That's true.
It's a ballet dancer
who's sort of dancing to the track. And Erasure themselves, they're in the Roxy, but it's completely deserted.
Yeah, they don't like...
Which, again, seems a perverse way to start, showing your exciting new pop show, and no one's turned up.
They look like a pair of buskers outside the entrance to a theatre.
But halfway through the track... through the magic of television.
Yes.
Suddenly the Roxy is filled with dancing, young, energetic people.
Well, yeah, and they're very particular kind of people. They're sort of... there'd be a young executives there. It's the yuppies.
Do you think? I was kind of thinking kind of like hairdressers and, you know, people who worked in Top Man.
Yeah, they're kind of... They're people who've got a bit of fashion sense. They've been told to come wearing their smartest clothes. But maybe it's my or sort of reverse snobbishness or whatever, but there's a sort of element of nouveau riche about them. No one.
You think these are people with NatWest Online accounts?
NatWest Online, second generation saving.
So that's what you're saying.
Oh, the sort of super save. Yeah, they'd have the gold cards and they've got. Well, the men are dressed in waistcoats and they've got ponytails and the women have got hats on. And it doesn't, to me, that is not an audience enjoying popular music.
Well, I think you're being very harsh there. So after,
but that's certainly not the Top of Pops audience, is it? Where if people at Top of Pops would come and they'd look as if they'd only just come out of school. They'd be either wearing
jeans or
a jumper, and they'd just grab whatever they could find. And that always made the Top of Pops audience look like it was... You felt part of it because it was ordinary people looking like ordinary, everyday folk. But here, do you not agree that they are that it's there's an element of staginess to the audience as well as everything else?
I think you're being a slightly harsh on the Roxy audience.
Maybe I just don't like those sort of people that have ponytails and wear waistcoats.
I don't think they all had ponytails and waistcoats.
Well, so in after, my head, they do.
So after Erasure's performance, we get Kevin and Kid welcoming us to their new abode.
Welcome to the Roxy, which each week will reflect Britain's fastest moving music survey, the Network Chart.
At this point, Kid makes a terrible error, in my view. He refers to the Network Chart, and we've already established my prejudice against the Network Chart, or perhaps to give it its full title, the Nescafé Network Chart.
Oh, really?
He refers to it as the fastest moving music survey. And, like, I have to say, as a 14-year-old, surveys are not what I want to see on TV.
And how can a survey be...
It's not a chart,
moving.
It's a survey.
How can it be moving?
It's fastest moving, Ian.
What does that mean?
Nothing.
It's an absolute nonsense phrase.
Absolutely. Well,
and a kid is not someone who I associate with talking nonsense.
And then, so following their introduction, then we get Alison Moyet.
I never
very traditional, it's very established performance, you know, we get close-ups of the band, close-ups of the musical instruments, as if to imply, you know...
It's all very authentic, it's all very earnest.
It's real music, folks. But again, she's miming, they're miming to the record.
Yeah.
So there's always a kind of feel like kind of there's a bit of a contract going on here. That they're trying to imply that this is kind of real music, whereas actually it's the same formula as Top of the Pops.
And already I was starting to wonder, where are the big hits?
Well, exactly. And then after Alison Moyet,
she's on your neck, before you know it.
We get Broken English. Now, do you have fond memories of Broken English?
I have no memories of them whatsoever.
Well, they did their song Coming On Strong.
Yes.
Which basically went,
she's coming on strong.
She's coming on strong. In a sort of sub Mick Jagger. It's basically Phil Cornwell doing a Mick Jagger, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. And they were all dressed in boiler suits, wasn't it?
Yeah.
With sunglasses. It was the worst kind of sort of cod rock, mock rock. And then, was that the end of the first half? Did it then just cut without any...
We go to a commercial break,
yeah.
And then out of the commercial break, we get Pepsi and Shirley. And so again, they're on the Roxy stage, aren't they? I think there's a bit of set dressing, isn't there? Sort of kind of mock sort of gates and
telephone box as well.
It's like they're performing in some kind of disused alleyway, isn't it? But one that's kind of conveniently situated on the set of the Roxy.
No, I have a new single coming out.
So after that, we get a very quick chat with Elkie Brooks, who just happens to have dropped by the Roxy studio. And from there we go into a video, which is it's a kind of remarkable video. It's Tom Jones. It's the re-release of It's Not Unusual. Yeah, it's back in the charts. It's archive footage of Tom Jones performing It's Not Unusual from the 60s.
Except
except
it's been subject to a special video, a new treatment.
Well, it's something. It's sort of been colourised, hasn't it? But oh, and there's dear, sort of always yes. kind of very kind of low grade TV trickery applied to it, and so which actually makes it look more dated now than the original footage would look.
Exactly right. Yeah, because if they had just showed the original, then you'd have taken it as face value. Okay, it's some 60s footage, and that would be the same today as it was then. But they've overlaid these really clumsy...
It's terrible, isn't it?
It's kind of...
It's really awful.
I don't know what package it would be to create these effects.
It's not Quantel. It's what...
The next one along,
it's basically, if you ask your mum to get Quantel, this is the one she would have come back with.
Yeah, because there'd be like a picture... Oh, let's have two Tom Joneses here, or let's
At one point, he's in an oval.
An oval
and,
shape.
And again, he's also in a rectangle. Yeah. So I think that demonstrates the technological versatility of whatever it was they were using.
Were they thinking, it's not, we can't just show the old footage. We need
yeah,
to make
absolutely,
somehow,
absolutely, that's what they were thinking.
Somehow
let's
look
make it look
contemporary.
Yeah, I quite enjoyed my toes were tapping along with Tom.
Well,
I've got to say,
in terms of the running order, that was the first decent song I think we've had.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get to the rest of the chart countdown.
Then we get to the rest of the chart rundown, and kids making these awful references to...
Going down, though, are the London combo with a pal called Johnny who hates jazz.
Instead of actually telling you what the song was.
Yeah.
And so from the top 10, we go into...
And this week at the top of the stack, it's Whitney Houston.
But we get about halfway. We join the video halfway through, and we got about a minute or minutes worth of it.
Now, how angry do you think they were? How disappointed the program makers were?
I imagine
the week of the launch, and they're stuck with a number one.
And they can't get the act
they can't
into
get
the
act.
Well, I imagine
it's
I
not
can,
even a British act. It's an American.
I can picture them sort of clustered around the fax machine, or possibly even the telex machine. Waiting for the Nescafe network chart to come down the line, and you know all their high hopes of getting the biggest pop name into the studio.
Who's it going to be? Oh, who could it be?
And it's Whitney. And they were kind of like, "Well, do you think we could get Whitney over to
Newcastle Tuesday?
Can we at least put a call in?
Yes.
And so kind of well, it's a no from Whitney. So. The finale is, I would argue, the biggest pop name of 1987.
Aren't they just? You know who they are. I'm talking about Curiosity Killed the Cat.
And they're performing...
Misfit.
And I think you'd agree, that this is the best song of the show.
I wouldn't argue with that at all. And, they felt fresh. They looked good. They looked like a kind of coherent. They looked like a proper pop group should. And they were kind of interesting in that they were huge for a very very short space of time.
Yes, and then pretty much disappeared completely.
Poor Ben Volavent Piero. And his beret.
But they had all the trappings.
Yeah.
They had the gimmicks.
Yeah. That's what you want.
The man with the odd name at the front. They had. everyone was kind of was putting in a performance.
Yes. Yeah. So, that's the end of the show. So it's 25 minutes long. And then to close out, we get what can only be described as a lot of admin from poor kid.
But don't forget, you can see the Roxy repeat here on ITV at 11:30 on Saturday mornings.
We don't really need to know because we've just watched it. So perhaps he's expecting us to watch it again.
Yes.
He tells us when the network chart is going to be... Sorry, the Nescafe network chart is going to be on your local independent radio station. He tells us where we can read about the Roxy on Oracle.
Read all about us on Oracle, page 196.
And so that's
takes up the entire time of the end credits, and it's like he's closing a meeting. Like any other business.
Yes, he's reading out the minutes. He's reading out the minutes of the first edition of the Roxy.
Our next meeting will be here, same time next week, and it's just, it just ends on the completely wrong tone. Although, I mean, the tone throughout the whole thing has been off, and it's been neither here nor there. And
should we talk about the ways that they were kind of trying to differentiate themselves from Top of the Pops. I mean, there are kind of things like they had like the latest music news scrolling along the bottom of the screen.
Yep, which was a distraction because it happened at the same time as people were talking.
Yeah, and it also felt like one of those first editions of a new big news show where they're literally throwing everything out to the screen in order to kind of impress you.
Yes.
So we actually need to talk about the scheduling of the Roxy, because I think this was one of the major factors in its downfall, in that it was never simulcast across the whole of the UK. It was on a Tuesday night, but in the Thames region, it was on at 6:30. In the Granada region, it was on at 7:30, which put it up against EastEnders, yeah, which was, you know, the juggernaut on, yes, TV at the time. And let me have a look at Grampian. It was on at 7:30 after the Paul Coyer show.
Oh, thank you. Hello. Thank you very much indeed.
So already there's kind of fractures in the scheduling. I think Thames actually, after a few months, put it out after midnight. So we're talking about an era where the ITV network wasn't really a network. Some, you know, some regions would get behind a show. Mm. Other regions would, you know, want to basically destroy it.
What happened to it then? It stayed in this slot or in this format.
It stayed in this format for 6 months until December 87.
Yeah,
it sort of went off. So there's no Christmas special of the Roxy. I think that was the point where I sort of realised that there was very little faith. If you're going to sort of put yourself up against Top of the Pops, then you have to have a Christmas Day Roxy, don't you?
Absolutely. Well, yes, by that point, yes, that's the giveaway.
And so then it came back in January 88 with an entire new look.
Roxy, the network chart show, and the countdown begins.
Kid had been sort of politely shown the door.
I hope.
Still sort of voiced the chart rundowns, but then we had the sort of
Nescafe chart rundowns.
The Nescafe network chart rundowns, obviously. So now there's this revolving door policy of presenters. Kevin Sharkey would sort of be accompanied by, I think, Pat Sharp joined the show at this time.
Do you know, Kevin and Paul have both told me to expect a great-looking viewer, and they were right.
I remember there was a couple of appearances by Paul Nolan.
Right, Australia are now celebrating their bicentenary, and we're going to go over to Elton to record it live in Australia.
Who was a former contestant on Blind Date. It didn't really kind of inspire much faith if you were tuning in different week on week and there were different faces every time. By this time, though, the show looked better. They'd got a set which looked completely different to Top of the Pops. The graphics looked completely different to Top of the Pops. I would argue that visually, that short period, the last 3 or 4 months of its life, it kind of looked better than Top of the Pops, but the constant revamps and constant shake-ups meant that in April 1988, the Roxy was axed. So that's 9 months after it launched.
It's terrible, really. It's forgotten about now, isn't it? It's written out of any narrative about music on television. Mm. Doesn't ever dwell on the Roxy.
Actually, what's interesting about the Roxy is that 1 year before it was launched, Channel 4 launched the chart show, which was completely different to Top of the Pops in that it was all videos and all computer graphics. And so that kind of ran intermittently for a few years, until the start of 1989, when it moved to ITV on Saturday mornings. So that, in effect, became, yeah, ITV's answer to Top of the Pops, yeah, which you would have to argue was completely different to Top of the Pops. Didn't look like it. It's all videos, no presenters, no annoying DJs. It didn't have the only chart that counts, but I didn't mind that so much.
Well, surely it was fascinating enough just to read about tour dates or
the band,
gossip.
The band's favourite food, yes, the band's nicknames.
As if a computer was feeding this information to us real time.
So I think what we can learn from that is that if you want to muscle in on a particular genre on TV, don't necessarily take the obvious
immediate
route. Look around for a format which tackles the same subject in a slightly different way.
Right, well, now it's my turn. And, Chris, I should say, before I show you the start of this programme, I'd like you to describe what you see as the programme begins.
Okay.
I think you'll probably recognise it fairly quickly,
right.
But the title sequence is one that needs a bit of contextualising, if that's okay?
Absolutely.
Right, so here we go.
Right, so we're seeing newspapers. Obviously, I've guessed what it is already. It's what the papers say.
What are we seeing?
So we're seeing footage of freshly printed newspapers being stacked up, intercut with cartoons and headlines from newspapers.
But of whom in particular did we see?
I think we saw Prime Minister John Major.
And how was he being depicted?
He was being depicted as a circus acrobat.
So before we go any further, would you care to take a guess as to when this particular episode of What the Papers Say?
I'm guessing it's from 1991 or 1992,
very,
that kind
very
of era.
Close. It's actually the week he became Prime Minister.
Oh, November 1990.
Absolutely. Okay, we're now going to watch the rest of What the Papers Say and we're going to talk about it afterwards. That was an edition of What the Papers Say that was shown on BBC Two on the 30th of November 1990, a historic week in this nation's great history when a new Prime Minister arrived at Downing Street, John Major.
John Major became Prime Minister.
Yeah, the very first question I need to ask you, Chris, is can you remember what you were doing when Margaret Thatcher resigned?
I'm enjoying this.
I was sitting in a PSD class.
Personal social development. Crikey. And how did the news reach you?
Someone burst in. I can't remember who. Someone burst in. I think he said, "She's gone."
That was all that needed to be said. What were you up to at this time?
I would have been studying for my A-levels.
Yeah.
I'd have been in my last year at school when all this was going on.
And did you read a newspaper regularly?
I would occasionally buy The Guardian. At this point, I was starting to become interested in the media and politics. So I do remember being quite gripped by the Conservative leadership contest after
Thatcher.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Because it was such an unlikely event as well. First of all, the fact that she'd gone anyway.
Yeah.
And then the fact that there's not one, but three people vying to become Prime Minister.
Well, Margaret Thatcher was actually the first Prime Minister I could remember, so I'd never sort of witnessed any kind of contest like this. So we should say the three candidates were John Major.
It is time to put up or shut up.
He obviously won. Douglas Hurd.
Hello! Who won the tooth for our Prime Minister? We've got to do something about British telecom.
And Michael Heseltine.
I think people forget that Douglas Hurd even considered himself a contender to be Prime Minister, because everyone knows that Heseltine was the person who brought about Thatcher's downfall, and obviously Major then became Prime Minister. But poor old Hurd.
Well, I think actually for quite a long period during the campaign, as I recall now, he was actually the favourite because he was Foreign Secretary. He was regarded as the safe pair of hands
who
could bring unity to the Conservative Party.
He wasn't Michael Heseltine. Heseltine was a very divisive figure, wasn't he?
Well, he was the man who sort of wielded the knife into Thatcher's back.
So
he was regarded with distaste by certain quarters of the Conservative Party, and also regarded as being a bit vulgar.
But he wasn't born into money.
He was a self-made man.
Exactly, and at the time,
very much cast himself as a self-made man.
And at the time, this was not something that which came instinctively to Conservative Party. Anyway, all of this is really to set the scene and to wonder whether this was an event that you would obviously have been following anyway.
Yes, but I would have been following it more on TV news rather than through the pages of the newspapers.
And I'm guessing, therefore, that you wouldn't have instinctively tuned into What the Papers Say.
No.
Did you ever tune into What the Papers Say?
I think it's the sort of thing that I might have watched if it was on, but it wasn't an appointment to view.
Well, who do you think was watching it then?
That's an interesting question. I imagine that it had sort of core audience of people who were interested in the news, who were interested in politics, who were interested in journalism. I don't think it would have had a very large sort of casual audience. I don't think it's the sort of thing that people would have tuned in religiously for.
Well, I have to confess, I did.
That's fine.
I did tune in for it.
Absolutely fine.
All through this period, the early 90s, I did try and watch. Well, I suppose it was the sort of thing I thought that I ought to be watching to keep my finger on the pulse.
I think it's one of those programmes that sort of, you know, it had heritage and it sort of added a bit of sort of luster and sort of history to your schedule without necessarily people watching it.
Well, that was very much, I think, in the thinking of Alan Yentob, who was the person who brought it to BBC Two. Previously, it started its life on ITV.
Yeah.
Granada Television made it throughout its entire life. It started from ITV, moved to Channel 4 in the 1980s, but when they dropped it, Yentob got on the phone to Granada. We'll have that. And it went on being made by Granada throughout its entire life. So of the people who would have been tuning in, I suspect the audience was mostly consisted of people who might be hoping to see their name mentioned in the programme, i.e.
Very possibly.
Journalists,
yes.
Columnists,
yes.
And probably were sneakily hoping that they would be subject to one of the programme's trademark impersonations.
Well, you would hope so, but it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because what the papers say seems to sort of exist to sort of satirise or sort of gently mock journalism and newspapers and their particular foibles and their faults and their flaws. So if you were being sort of if your work was being highlighted on what the papers say, that might not be a great thing.
Well, there are two people who are sent up by virtue of Silly Voices. The first was most preposterously is Sir John Junior.
Yes.
F. Mr. Michael Heseltine, whom Mr. Hattersley correctly describes as a complete second ritter, and who struts around wearing a brigade of guards tie, although he didn't even complete his national service, climaxes his successful insurrection against Mrs. Thatcher by emerging from the new ballot as Prime Minister without public consent. It will be a crime against the nation.
Who's treated to deliberately over the top impersonation,
which I kind of find fascinating, and I think that sort of plugs into sort of the tone of the show, which is very sort of in with the industry. It's very much an old boys club kind of show. So I imagine 99.9% of the people watching wouldn't really know how John Junior actually spoke, and obviously it's a parody of wildly exaggerated parody of how he spoke, but yeah, we wouldn't have known whether that was on the money or not.
But the other person who gets sent up is Germaine Greer.
You could shudder when she turned out her wardrobe and gave women little tips on how to keep their bows fresh.
Who's given this the most stereotyped Australian?
When her 3-inch heels dumped her into a hole in the pavement that a CAP local authority had no money to fix.
It's just kind of a vague approximation of someone from Neighbours.
But there's something I quite like about the vague approximation school of impersonation.
Well, let's give a name check to the three voice artists here. There's one woman, Delia Corrie.
Just who do women find the most sexy?
And two men, David Marlowe.
Mr. Hurd may be correct, both in his definition of social mobility and about his father's modest circumstances.
And Peter Wheeler.
What you won't see any more now is the vulgarity into which the paper has slipped over the past 2 or 3 weeks.
How would you rate their contributions to this programme?
I think what they do is exactly what it needs. Because, you know, if you've got 15 minutes of TV, which is largely sort of quotations from newspapers, you can't be dry about that. It would be really, really boring. So they basically just kind of send up the whole thing. They send up the quotes that they're reading. They're sending up the newspapers that the quotes have come from. So they do the job that they need to do for the programme to work.
And to be fair to them, they are equally mocking of highbrow.
The job went to a lovely little Jamaican lady who was rather tubby.
And lowbrow.
Bollocks to the press council.
Newspapers.
I think that's one of the great strengths of what the papers say, is that it didn't come at the world of newspapers from any one particular direction. Obviously, you know, a lot of it relied on the guest presenter. So it had a different sort of journalist presenting every week, didn't it? So, you know, they pretty much all of them would have ranged high or low, from tabloids to broadsheets and back again.
But, we go right from the Sport, Sunday Sport, isn't it?
Yes.
All the way up to the Times.
Well, they actually open in this week of all weeks where Britain's got a new Prime Minister. The first item under discussion on what the papers say is a change of editorship at the Sunday Sport.
Yeah, it's a slightly contrary approach, isn't it? You can imagine they think, well, let's wrong foot the audience slightly.
Yeah.
Journalists Week made an important announcement today.
Bollocks out, pollocks in.
I thought this might be a racy reference to the Heseltine Major leadership tussle, but no. It was an announcement about a change of editorship at one of our most famous organs of opinion and comment.
And start off with this, which is kind of really just predicated on the fact that the new editor's name is Ian Pollock. And so that allowed them to do a bit of a play on words. But, of course, the whole thing is tied together, as you said, by the host. And this week's host is Peter Mackay of the Evening Standard.
Yes.
Now, how do you think he acquitted himself to this task?
Well, I think he acquitted himself perfectly well. I think that's a difficult gig.
Yes.
Hosting what the papers say and weaving all the kind of quotes and voices and stories together. It's kind of ironic that he acquitted himself well, because obviously he had a certain amount of notoriety in the pages of Private Eye, where they rechristened him Peter Mackay. I think because he did gain something of a reputation for being liberal with the truth. I think he worked on the launch of the Daily Star.
It's got to be Britain's Best Buy, and it's only sixpence.
He did, yes, for the late 70s, then into the early 80s.
Anyway, I think he kind of acquits himself very well.
He does, I noticed, resort to some what you might call sort of placeholder sentences.
Yes.
Because at one point he says,
I don't wish to know that.
Or,
be sure your sins will find you out.
These don't add anything whatsoever.
No, but they keep the show on the road, don't they?
Yes, because it's one of those programmes where you have to... the rhythm of the programme requires you to keep cutting back to the presenter, even when the presenter has nothing whatsoever to add. So they have to kind of add a,
Sounds good to me.
Just to link all the different quotes from the papers together.
Well, of course, it's a bit similar to Points of View.
Absolutely.
Which you might remember we've covered in a different programme.
Points of View, and I'm going to assume... Is it Barry era or is it...
Barry Took was hosting.
Mm.
And there's a
Doing
similarity.
Doing exactly the same job, I would say.
Yes, it's taking a sort of a collection of material and weaving it together into something which can work as a continuous, a sort of developing story.
Yeah.
Now, I wonder whether in this Mackay constructed this running order himself, or whether the production team, of which there are quite a few names were listed at the end, did all the research and they went to him, here's this week's quotes, Peter.
You would imagine that he would have assembled it with some amount of assistance.
Yes.
I don't think he was...
We'll spend the whole week researching.
Cutting out bits out of the paper. That'll be good on Friday night, yes. I'll use that. But I think it probably has his own stamp on it. I think the script has his own stamp on it, you would imagine. One thing I really wanted to talk about with this programme is that it's 1990. It's 27 years ago. But it feels, in some respects, like it might be 50 or 67 years ago.
And things ain't what they used to be.
There's so many kind of defunct institutions. We get quotes from The Independent.
Things ain't what they used to be.
We get quotes from Today. We even get quotes from the last ever edition of The Sunday Correspondent.
Which only lasted a year or so, did it? Or even less than that?
There's a reference to Max Bygraves penning a song called Come Back Maggie.
Yes.
Things ain't what they used to be.
I mean, the era where, you know, you would refer to the Prime Minister as Maggie.
That feels
so long ago. I think kind of with all the sort of present political turmoil, this almost kind of started to feel like kind of distant history.
It feels much longer ago than it does. And that's reflected in the nature of the coverage, the fact that we have these long, in-depth pieces looking at the wives of the candidates.
Judy Heard. She is the one who lives most through her husband. Even her outside interests are linked to her husband's work.
Well, I never.
It's interesting that when we hear someone trying to do a voice of John Major. Mm. It's not the voice that we expect.
If you haven't done an hour and a half's work before 7:30 a.m. and then gone into a transport cafe for breakfast, I promise you, you haven't lived.
We are right at the genesis of the formation of John Major's public image. This is entirely pre the grey image, the underpants outside the trousers,
yes.
the peas on spitting image.
The peas are good tonight, dear.
This is all before that.
I know, it's all still to come. And what a prospect that would have been at the time. All this was still to come.
But it's fascinating to see that at the time he was kind of seen as, you know, this character who'd sort of built himself up from, you know, a two-room flat in Brixton to beat off, you know, the old Etonian, you know, Douglas Hurd, and the thrusting self-made Michael Heseltine.
Well, his blandness was seen as a virtue.
Yes.
Following, and I can understand why, because yes, following 11 years of Maggie, this was part of the, well, this is a big part of his appeal, especially up to the election, the 1992 election.
Yeah.
He was able to be cast as the opposite, a new start,
absolutely,
a blank piece of paper, who was not going to go in for the same sort of aggressive, divisive politics that his predecessor had done. Which, and it's interesting to see that coming through in the headlines, they're talking about...
He is under 50, reared in a post-war world, brought up on the wrong side of the tracks. He is refreshing and stuffy and has an ambition which will feed upon itself to widen the opportunities for everybody in this land.
But it's interesting that actually, if you were almost look at the timeline, the actual the actual point where he became boring John Major, it's not very long. The honeymoon period is very short, isn't it?
Well, he had, if memory serves, he had the luck of, well, as much as it was luck, of inheriting the Gulf War from Thatcher.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was able to portray himself as an unlikely war leader.
Yes.
There now follows a ministerial broadcast by the Prime Minister, the Right Honourable John Major, MP.
Since before dawn today, Britain's forces have been in action in the Gulf.
After that, we had the man of the people, the soapbox and everything else.
Yeah.
Which saw him through to the 92 election and saw him win. But yeah, then it was anything goes for another 5 years.
I know. But isn't it kind of, it's almost vaguely nostalgic. To see kind of political turmoil seem so self-contained.
Yes.
And, you know, it didn't seem to kind of impact upon us as much as the political turmoil of 2017, where just everything just feels entirely apocalyptic.
Yes. Well, it's like the establishment sort of reshuffling itself here.
Yeah.
We've lived through a most curious time. The candidates vied for our approval, but we could not vote for them. That was the job of 372 Tory MPs.
We're spectators of it. We were just watching. It doesn't really affect us. And there was a passing reference to Neil Kinnock, hoping that this would improve Labour's chances.
We can whip them now,
says Kinnock.
But otherwise, almost the entire 50 minutes was solely about the machinations of the Conservative Party and the replacement of one Prime Minister with another. But with none of the tone of the similar replacement that we had here last year, where everything was painted in much more lurid and dramatic terms, because it was bound up with such much more dramatic circumstances.
1990 sort of feels, it's 27 years ago. In some ways it feels a long time ago, in other ways it doesn't. But it kind of, the way the sort of politics is sort of addressed in the media and now in social media, it just, even though it was slightly more deferential, but it seems so much less hysterical.
Yes.
So do you think that what the papers say now would be irrelevant in an era of, you know, social media and BuzzFeed and so on? Do you think it could work?
I think its absence is a shame because of the way the media is now part of our everyday conversation again, whether it's true or fake news, whether it's the extent to which certain newspapers are influencing national politics and vice versa, I don't think there'll be any problem in widening it to include online media as well. Yeah. In a sense, we actually need it more than ever to remind people that, yes, the Daily Mail, the Dead Express or whatever have run these sensationalist stories, headlines. Yeah. But at the end, they are just letters on a page, on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And they could do with being taken down a bit.
I agree. I do tend to think, though, if you were showing something that was printed on Monday on a Friday, these days, it would feel like ancient history.
There's a bit of
that thing we all kind of chewed over on Twitter on Monday afternoon. Suddenly, by Friday, it's old news, isn't it? The pace and the cycle of news seems to have accelerated beyond all imagination since 1990.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I miss it in a way, but it's a bit of an antiquated format. And I don't think we've got quite the same sort of personalities who would present it these days, apart from Hislop, who's still around, Andrew Neil. But Andrew Neil's now a presenter, isn't he?
Yeah.
So in terms of the name, we don't have the same sort of personality journalists anymore, do we?
No.
I realise, Chris, that I haven't yet asked you whether you actually enjoyed this edition of What the Papers Say.
I really enjoyed seeing it, both from a sort of historical perspective and also from a TV point of view. See this kind of sort of classic little gem of a show, which used to sort of adorn schedules for 15 minutes. You know, it's just fascinating to be sort of reminded of that period in sort of British political history. And it was a show which completely succeeded on its own terms. It was entertaining, it was informing, it was funny. I really enjoyed it. You've been listening to What We Just Watched from TV Cream, in which we watched The Roxy from the 9th of June 1987...
and What the Papers Say from the 30th of November 1990.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.